Awesome to welcome Samford head coach Matt Wise to the basketball podcast. Coach Wise just completed his first year at Samford and completed a storybook first season as head coach of the women's basketball program. Taking over after 3 years as associate head coach, Wise led the Bulldogs to the Southern Conference Tournament Championship as the number six seed. Samford rallied from an early 1-6 start in conference play and a 6-8 regular season, SoCon mark, to win three straight tournament games, capped by a dramatic 72-67 upset of top-seeded Chattanooga in the title game. The victory delivered the program's fourth SoCon championship and its first NCAA tournament berth since 2012, turning a rebuilding year into one of the most improbable runs in conference history. Hey, Coach, brief interruption from your podcast to hear from one of our top supporters, Hoopsalytics. Is your starting lineup not performing to your expectations? What if your star player is injured? Who should you play together instead? You can answer questions like this using the powerful Hoopsalytic basketball platform to reveal your most productive players and lineups. Just ask the AI assistant, and based on extensive player and lineup stats and analytics, you'll get accurate, data-driven answers instantly. You can literally ask anything about teams and players and then start making even better strategic decisions. Hoopsalytics also provides top-tier video link stats with a 12-hour turnaround time, as well as handy visualizations, interactive shot charts, coaching stats, easy-to-create film sessions, and lots more. And unlike the alternatives, you get unlimited video storage with no hidden fees. Best of all, Hoopsalytics is more affordable. Now in year seven, Hoopsalytics is a true game changer for thousands of basketball coaches. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball and start using advanced stats and AI to win more games today. Matt, welcome back to the basketball podcast.
Thank you for having me back.
I said it when we did the first one. I thought this is a unique experience. A first year head coach. We'll do one before and we'll do one after. And I mentioned it, storybook ending a little bit, but let's not go there yet. Let's start with you started your first year as a head coach, and certainly there were some struggles early. Take us through that thought process as you were into those struggles.
Yeah, we had I believe it finished as the 23rd ranked non-conference strength of schedule. We played six guarantee games, five of those against power fours, most of which were in the top 50. As we laid out that schedule, even one of them was we understood we were coming back from a trip to a Big Ten school. We played them on a Monday. We were coming back on a Tuesday with full day travel. And then Thursday, we were playing a 10 a.m., 11 a.m. education game on the road. And so it's once you take that guarantee game, you're pretty much solidifying almost no chance to be physically recovered and mentally recovered for that game. So we were set up schedule-wise for a lot of struggle. And I knew that, and I liked that. I don't know that I got the 18 to 23-year-olds to fully comprehend that it was a good thing, because with us implementing all new for the most part, offense, defense, everything we were executing, I wanted to get it all tested so that we could work out all the kinks. And in a lot of ways, we did that. The problem was, in any sport, confidence is huge, and everybody knows that, and everybody reads the books and listens to people talk about how to create confidence, right? I think because of the size and athleticism, especially inside your conference, the disparity in women's college basketball is so small that really belief and confidence, and it can be belief and confidence in your own abilities, or belief and confidence in the things you run, or belief and confidence in each other, or whatever it might be. That's the difference between teams that perform at a high level and teams that don't. And so while I loved how we got tested in the non-conference, when we got into conference play, we lacked belief and confidence, and we had a lot of uncertainty. And it showed, and we played on our heels and played hesitantly. And that's how we got off to the 1-6 start in conference play. There were some uncertain moments at those times.
One of the reasons, and for those that aren't informed, I've been in many coaches' offices in the spring and seen what's on their board in terms of schedule, like in your circumstance. And the obvious question is why? Why are you playing those games? And part of it is because of the money to fund everything you're trying to do at Samford, you're getting money to play those games. It's a reality and it's something that helps your program. But as you said, the challenge is that your players don't necessarily value that idea as much as the coolness of playing some of these teams. But the answer is balance, I assume, in terms of trying to set up a schedule that kind of builds confidence, but still meets some of the criteria that you need to be able to run your program.
Correct. But we also have a unique issue in that until next year, we have a team coming into the conference. We only had eight teams in the SOCON. And so you played all the other seven opponents twice. So that's 14 games. You got to find another 15 to 17 games to squeeze in for the months of November and December. So you're playing two and three games a week. And so we ran the numbers, and from the time we started games to the time we got to conference play, we had five practices that were not the day before a game. So five times where you are solely preparing on you. Because even as we got ready for a lot of these P4 games, we still tried to keep the focus on us and not too much on the opponent. But you're only going so hard and so long the day before a game. And you do have to do a little bit of prep, especially if you're going against one of these teams that press. You got to do some work on your press offense to make sure you can even survive getting the ball across half court, right? So again, you're not working on the nuances of your half court defense or your half court offense or your set execution. And that made it hard to get better through that course in practice. We were getting better in games, but it's hard to get better in practice like that.
Such a great insight there in terms of that. And we talked about it briefly, but you retained coming into your first year 11 of the 13 players through relationship building clarity. You talked about that. That's including recruits, incoming recruits. Talk to us about both the benefit and the challenge of that.
The obvious benefit is they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And so, with the established relationships, there was an innate trust. The challenge probably would be in that while culturally we were very similar to the years past when I was an assistant coach, we were very different systematically, schematically, if you will. And so, for them to learn that stuff, it was like learning a new language. And so there's a time period that takes. But the benefit of the relationships was going through the struggle allowed us to not fall apart. We had a couple games in the conference play when we started on the 1-6 stretch where right after the game, frustrations were all-time high. And I just remember grabbing the team in a huddle right after a game and just pulling them really tight. And I just said, please don't break. Please don't break. That's all I'm asking you to do. I'm telling you, we will find a way. Just please don't break. And to their credit, they never did.
So you referenced that 1-6 start to conference, and a little bit of that is what you've talked about already. What do you attest to some of the other reasons for that kind of slow start? And again, coaches, the ending of this is beautiful because you got playing great basketball at the right time. So we don't want to think that, but we want to take you through the ups and downs of a first-year head coach.
The good part is you go from the 23rd ranked non-conference strength of schedule into conference play, and five of your first seven are on the road. So it couldn't have gotten any better. But one of the things that I tried to establish in the culture and is this kind of appreciation. I think I've heard Pete Holmes, the comedian, talk about yes, thank you as his mentality. Like when something bad happens or something, whatever happens, yes, thank you. And it just triggers you perspective wise and to accept things differently. And mine was good, is like we had gone to practice one day in the midst of our despair and it was raining. And I said, I gotta tell you, I'm so grateful that it's raining for the challenge. I came out, saw the rain, I thought, good. And it became such an obnoxious joke that the staff and players kept saying to me, but anytime something bad would happen, a bus breakdown, or we're late for something, or just something doesn't go our way, they'd all jokingly, mockingly at me go, good. But through the humor, it became a perspective shift of the challenge. Almost think Ryan Holiday, the obstacle is the way. Here's the new challenge. Great. Let's go attack it. And so we just had fun with that. And so even as times got really tough, we were almost like excited that the times were tough. If that is insane, I don't know.
But sometimes that's what sport brings out, a little bit of insanity to deal with kind of the ups and downs of it. And these organic moments that come from a season are obviously some battle cries, so to speak, to be able to help your team going. So that's such a great example. I am curious from you, because I remember my first year as a head coach very vividly. And people don't think about this, but you talked about players struggling with confidence. But you, as a head coach, especially early in your career, you struggle with confidence too. I did immensely, where there were these moments of doubt taking over a team that inevitably was going to have some struggles, was set up to have struggles. And it's like this doubt into my mind that I'm like, am I actually doing a good job? Am I actually doing the right things? All these different questions that you pose, and you go through this great introspection. Maybe can you take us through some of that process of fighting for your own confidence and fighting for your own belief and the different things that come with that?
I would love to sit here and tell you that I didn't bat an eye and I looked it in the face and I never doubted for a second. Yeah, of
Well, you're
course.
talking to coaches here. You can be honest, because that's the media answer that everyone wants.
Oh, no, it's not even close to the truth. Of course, I doubted. I doubted if I knew what I was doing. I doubted if the way we were teaching was right, if what we were running was right, if the players we were playing was right. Doubted if I was good enough, if we as a staff were good enough, if we have, as a team were good enough. I think what can't be stated enough for anybody, a player, a coach, a human being, is to have people in your corner makes all the difference in the world. And yes, our staff continued to pour into me individually. My family pour into me, but on campus, I had Lenny Acuff. I had some sit downs with him where I was really doubting our men's coach at Samford. And he said, I'm telling you, I've watched you practice, I've watched you play, you're doing so much better than you think you are. And you are going to have so much success. You just can't see it yet. And so I got a little mad that he was so right with how the season ended, because he wasn't supposed to be right that fast, but I'll forgive him for it.
Well, Lenny's one of the great ones, and that's great to have someone like that to help add some support and so just a voice of reason, I guess, some common sense, because that sometimes doesn't exist in your coaching bubble for sure. You talked about the overwhelming volume of decisions when you first got the job. Everything from, again, where are the water bottles, where do they look like, all these different kind of details. So take us through that kind of what changed throughout maybe your first year when it came to decision making, or did it stay the same?
It kind of ebbs and flows, right? You figure out, plug one hole and another one leaks. And so I thought we got really good as a staff because we do put in a lot of time meeting as a staff. If my, I've said this before, but my mom would never want to work for me. She hated staff meetings and we meet every single day for multiple hours. But that level of communication and chemistry on the staff, one, it bled over to the players, but two, we were so on the same page as far as decision making, as far as what needed to get done. There was just such clarity of roles, of expectations, of standards. In fact, there was one practice. This is a true story. I hate admitting this, but this is a true story. It's Saturday morning, and I'm heading to the office at, I leave my house at 9:45 for practice at 2 o'clock. I had breakfast with the kids, got them squared away with my wife. I take off. And as I get in the car, I get a text from one of our assistants said, "Are you on the way?" And I thought, "Oh man, what fire do I have to put out? What's going on?" And I text back, "Why? What happened?" And he texts back, "Practice starts in 15 minutes." Practice was at 10, and I thought it was at 2. And so I'm rushing in, and so I'm on the phone with him. I tell him, tell the other assistants to take the players to the floor, start doing individuals. I cannot believe I'm sharing this out loud. Take the players to the floor, start doing individuals. And he and I wrote the practice plan while I'm on the phone driving in. And I'm telling him, then we're going to do this, then we're going to do that. I thought through what it would be, but I hadn't put it all on paper. And so we go to practice and we go through it and it's fine. But afterwards, the staff, we sit down and debrief. And they said, "We will never make fun of us meeting ever again because we didn't have a clue what was coming next in practice." And as far as like all those little decisions, I think having the team around you and being able to communicate through them, prepare each other for them, it makes a huge difference. But like I said, so you plug that hole, Now there's like the little decisions of in game. We all think about substitution patterns or who you're going to sub. We all think about what you're going to run. But okay, you've got what you're going to run. And for whatever reason, your point guard can't handle the pressure of their point guard. Now what are you going to run? Okay, you've got your substitution pattern in mind of how you're going to get these allotted minutes. Plus, we had injuries with minute restrictions. And now, oh, two fouls in the first 2 minutes. Now how are you going to handle it? And that stuff I thought would come with the position. What I didn't think about coming with the position is, do you want to stand as a head coach the whole time to portray energy, to portray a belief and confidence and swagger of standing? Or do you fully trust your team and you sit down? Do you want to be able to collaborate with your assistants on the bench? Or are you sitting and now lowering the energy of the players that are on the floor? Going to a timeout, do you want to huddle as a staff and communicate any questions, any messaging? Do you have time to do that based on your league and how long they run their full timeouts? We'd get ready for a P4 game. I went down, I sat down, I talked, I went through the adjustments, I told them the play we're going to run, stand up, and we had a minute and a half left. Those kind of things were definitely learning lessons on the fly.
I love that. Thanks for sharing that vulnerability. We've all been there as a coach. Like as a head coach, definitely. I've always had those moments where it's, oh, wait, what? And then yeah, it's you're human. And normalizing that and for yourself especially is such a benefit if you can get there. So many things, I'm sure you had your idea, right? You've taken your notes, you've taken your kind of concepts that you've learned throughout your whole coaching career, and you said, if I'm ever a head coach, I'm gonna do this. But all that goes out the window because, again, at the end of the day, you just got to figure it out. You got to figure it out on the fly. So, what were some things maybe mid-season during the season that you ended up changing from what you thought at the beginning of the season?
So one of the things I talked with you about before the season started was I wanted to run as part of our offense an off-the-ball screening motion. And we instituted it in the preseason, we put it in the non-conference, and for whatever reason, it's just not clicking. It's just they would just completely stand still. They would get completely frozen, or they would go to set a screen and they would just exchange. And we got literally nothing out of it. And I was teaching it the way I thought it would be comprehended. I couldn't understand why they weren't grasping it. And we had gone to Minnesota, who runs an off the ball motion. They run a great offense and they kicked our tail. And so the following week, we pulled clips of Minnesota, not versus us, versus other opponents, running their offense. And in the middle of practice, we brought them over to a TV screen. We showed them like five, six clips of Minnesota running it. And then we went out and we executed it. I can't tell you why that was the light switch that worked, but they went out there and the whole staff started looking around at each other. Is this about to be the only offense we run? Because this is ridiculous. And it went from the two benefits. One, that day of connection. And two, we started playing some players who added some defensive toughness, but were really struggling offensively from remembering plays to executing screens to offensive production. And so it became the default offense when they came in the game to give us a lift in rebounding and defense because there was no thinking. And the combination of them seeing the success of it and us having to run it in games was incredible as far as a shift. And this was right around the non-conference to conference switchover. And we, in non-conference, I think we probably ran the offense 2 to 4 times a game, max four, but it was really like once or twice a game. And early in conference play, we probably were running it 3 to 6 times a game. In the back half of conference play and in the postseason, I think we were probably running a third of our offense as the off-ball motion, a third as the on-ball motion, and a third as of sets, which is what I always envision and hope for. But man, was it hard to get it to click for a long while.
That's amazing. And people don't appreciate this as much as coaches appreciate this because we live this, is you are constantly throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks. That's a reality of coaching. Nobody goes into the season and has all the answers. And then that's good from day one to the end of the year. And that's part of it, adaptability. You talked about that on the first podcast. You knew you'd have to be adaptable and you were. Where were some other areas maybe that adaptability became so important?
Definitely early in non-conference was charge taking. I talked with you about that before the season. Obviously, being from Larry Scheid's coaching tree, charges were going to be a non-negotiable. We drilled it, we worked it, and we had some players reluctant. We had some players whose charge taking technique was not exactly going to sell the call. And that one we doubled down on. We stayed the course, we continued to do it. Working it, drilling it, breakdowns, small segments of practice, bonus points in live play, and just kept encouraging it. And that really caught on in conference play for us. We ended up leading the league in charges taken and of anything, maybe as much as the championship. I'm as proud of that. The other, you asked about the adjustments along the way. And I would say one of them was the personnel we were playing. Is we were struggling offensively, and especially in the slate that we had in the non-conference. And so I felt a need to continue to play some players that were not playing as well defensively, but I thought could produce offensively, though they weren't producing great offensively. I just thought it would come. And it's fascinating. We ended up shifting to a bit of a tougher lineup throughout the course of the conference slate and into the postseason. And what's fascinating is by playing players that played harder defensively, we ended up getting more stops, which allowed us to get out and run offensively, which allowed our offensive efficiency to go up. So by playing players that weren't as good offensively, we ended up first in points per possession, top two in field goal percentage, 3-point percentage, 2-point percentage, assist rate, like every offensive category, we finished top two in the league in. And it was honestly by playing tougher players.
So when did that happen? When did that adjustment take place?
Right about the time we were 1-6, I was really struggling to pull the trigger on making the switch. There were some players that I thought we were playing in a smaller role. And when they came in, it would be like they'd get a tough-nosed rebound or they'd take a charge, and then we wouldn't score three straight possessions and I'd pull them out because I just felt like we were so limited offensively with them out there. And it got to a point where we were getting demolished on the board. So we were dead last in rebounding, offensive rate, defensive rate, overall. We were getting destroyed on the boards. And so we discussed it as a staff. And ironically, we came to the agreement and I told him, I'm doing it. I'm pulling the trigger. I'm making the switch. And I crossed paths with my athletic director. And I thought it was a little bit of a God wink, made this decision to do this. And I crossed paths with him. And he tells me, he said, "Hey, I want to share a story with you." I said, "Okay." He said, "When Bucky was here, Bucky McMillan, who's now at Texas A&M, in his first year, he came to me and said, 'Hey, I got to play some tougher players and I might sacrifice some wins, but this is going to be better for this culture long term and we're going to win in the long term.' And he said, 'I think you might need to consider that line of thinking.' I'm not telling you to play, but I just think you might need to consider." And it was like, okay, I was already about to do this. Now I just got the green light that he's gonna be okay if this doesn't work. And sure enough, we started going on a winning streak, and he would text me, "Tough players play, tough players win," after our wins. So
That's very cool. And it speaks to the fact that I think generally the story that's told is the new head coach takes over. The team has this fully successful year from beginning to end, and that's the one that gets publicized. But your story demonstrates that you can figure it out during the season. And that doesn't just apply to first-year head coaches, but that's great. But again, how good was it to have the support of your athletic director in that too? Like he wasn't going, "Oh, I made the wrong decision," or anything like that. He had belief that you would figure it out too. And that self-efficacy from him to you, and your self-efficacy to your staff, and your staff to you, and vice versa, all of that is such a nice circle, isn't it? To be able to go, "Hey, coach, I'm excited to let you know that we just released a full 86-minute masterclass on how we developed youth players and teams in simple and easy to apply ways. These are the same methods that I used with local teams here in Los Angeles that have gone from getting beat by 30 to beating teams by 30. At Basketball Immersion, we coach kids for the long term, so they're still engaged, confident, and improving later in their basketball career, not just winning games at 8, 9, and 10. When you join, you get access to a youth coaching masterclass that's transforming programs around the world plus our full library of incredible ready-to-use resources and courses. This masterclass alone is worth the investment, and your players will thank you. Go to basketballimmersion.com/sales today to get started. Curious in this offseason then, before we get to the ending of the story, you're in this offseason period now. What are you doing to get 360 feedback from all the different parties within your program?
It's fascinating because of the way that the calendar lies. We go play in the NCAA tournament, and the following week happens to be my kids' spring break. And so I had to take them to Disney World for the week. So I come back and we immediately meet with players about who's staying and who's going. And then it's the Final Four out in Phoenix. So I go out there for a few days. I come back, and now we're getting final decisions on who's staying and who's going. We haven't even had a chance to debrief yet. And so it's fascinating. I almost want to ask you is, because I trust your opinion and your show, is what is the best line of questioning for your staff to get? Is it positives and correctables? Is it what would we have done differently? Is it highs and lows? Like, how do you present the question for the best feedback to develop on?
Again, you outlined it there. My whole thing was to get honest feedback. I first had to get past the good feedback because everyone inherently, they're on your team, you're on your staff, they want to give you the good feedback. So it was as simple as this. I said, give me three things that you feel we should continue doing. And it could be anything within our program. Three things that we could be doing that we should continue doing. And then once they sent that, then I would go to all of them and say, okay, now we're going to meet. And I always believed in this concept of the 1 minute meeting where it was like not going to be long. It was going to be very specific and we weren't going to go off to any tangents. There was no tangent allowed. It was going to be this 1 minute meeting where I wanted you to lay out one thing that you feel we need to change to be better. And it was like just getting them to focus on, okay, get beyond the happies and the positives. Okay, yes, you've got a job, we're good. Now let's get to the thing that actually can help us. And that's the hardest thing, but that was the thing. But it was the same thing in my program. We had way more time than you had, but it's still that concept of going, when do we actually do this? And I remember so many times my athletic director was like, oh, we got to meet on the season evaluation and all this other stuff. And it just never happened. And it just never happened. It wasn't like I was pushing for that necessarily either, but I
Right.
did want the feedback, but it wasn't necessarily that formal process that always happened. You mentioned, you can comment there if you want, but you also mentioned that retaining your players was something that you did. So talk to us about that process, because I know a lot of people are in that position of your program, not just you, retain players in a time where it's really hard to retain players, especially at your level.
Yeah, I mean, we were able to retain 7 of our 10, and we were able to keep 3 of our 5 starters, 5 of our top 7 rotationally, with the 2 that we lost being to graduation. And so we were able to, I think one of the things that we were able to do was, and I'm blessed with a good staff, is I think the players, they felt loved it and accepted for exactly who they are. That's a Billy Donovanism. Everybody in the world wants to feel loved, appreciated, and accepted for who they are. And I think they felt that. And because of the way our season went, they can't say they didn't get better. They felt like they got better. We had 10 of our 14 have career highs in points. It was such a progression that I think that feeling loved and cared for and feeling the sense of accomplishment and development. Yes, there is money out there that will buy you happiness, but happiness is easy. I could go to the movies right now with a big bucket of popcorn. I'll be happy. But you can manufacture happiness and it comes and it goes. And I think that what they got to feel was belonging and fulfillment. When you get better, you feel fulfilled. And when you feel you're around people that love and appreciate you for who you are, you feel a sense of belonging. And I think that those sometimes the dollar signs are a lot, but I think that was how we were able to keep them.
So I'm curious, and we can go down this road now. How much of winning at the end of the season helped that?
Oh, there's no question. There's no question because it's, yes, it was joyful. And yes, it was exciting and it was happy and all those emotions. But I think what it was for me personally, and I think for a lot of our players and staff, was it was a stamp of not necessarily approval, but a stamp of you are as good as you think you are.
Proof of
Or
concept.
that's the term I was looking for. That's what it was. And the truth is, you shouldn't need it. If you're not enough without it, you'll never be enough with it, kind of thing. But that validation, man, like we all want to know we're good enough. Like I don't care who you are, whatever you're doing in life, you want it could be from parenting to any sort of profession to college athletics, you want to know you're good enough. You want to know you're enough. And so I think when you add that to the office, you get a sense that, the juice was worth the squeeze.
So we talked about already the 1-6 conference start, and if I'm 6-8 to end conference, and then obviously won games in your tournament to be able to win your conference tournament as a 6 seed and go to the NCAA tournament. Take us through that stretch then. You already referred to some of the things that led to that turnaround, but take us through that stretch. How did you keep that momentum and that confidence going particularly?
One of the things that we talked about before the season started, you and I did, was the Jim Collins flywheel, right? Was like you push and you push and you push. And at some point, the wheel catches and it takes off. And the momentum is so great, there's no stopping it. And people go, which push was it that got, I don't know. Which meeting by our staff was it? Which practice session was it? Which mental skills training session was it? Which night of playing games the night before a game was it that like caught? I don't know. But I know that we kept pushing, and there was no pushback, not by the players, not by the staff. There was no fractions. There was nothing that kept the momentum from building as slowly as it was building. I'll share this story with you. The learning lesson is, so we go on our big run, and we win 5 out of 7 or 6 out of 8 in conference. And as we're going into the last game at home with a good chance to play our way into the 5 seed. The thing is, the result of our game, we're playing ETSU. The result of our game did not matter. It was going to be based on the result of 2 other games for what seed we finished with. Basically, if the team who had led our conference all season long from the 1 seed, Chattanooga, if they won at the team that we were tied for 5th place, we were going to get the 5 seed. If they didn't, we were going to get the 6 seed, guaranteed. And so we're going into this game, and this is a lesson I learned the hard way, is their game started before ours, and I'm watching, and I'm seeing Mercer beat Chattanooga, and I'm watching, and I can see it in the body language and the effort of Chattanooga. They're not going to win this game. And I'm thinking, boy, we're going to be the 6th seed. And so we go to start our game. Here's the catch that really got me kind of whacked out mentally. It was almost guaranteed that we were going to play ETSU, the team we're playing, 4 days later in the first round in the 6-3 round. So it's in my head. And do you show all your cards? How do you handle this? Are you worried about minutes? Are you worried about keeping players safe? Or how do you approach this? And so it's in my head. And I wouldn't say I held back anything coaching wise. I just don't think that energy wise, I was at my peak.
Extra hard because you've been playing so well too. So it's not like
So
you
well.
want to lose that momentum after building it.
Which is that was what I sided on of I'm gonna play everybody no matter what the way we would to win, and I'm gonna call it like I would to win. But I know me, and I know I wasn't at my best. And what's crazy though is we play this game, and it's like the final minute or whatever, the closing seconds, we're losing, and our strength coach is sitting at the front of the bench behind the scorer's table, and I turned to him and I said, "Hey, who won the Wofford Furman game, one of the other games that was going to depend on seeding?" And he tells me that game also had an upset. And so we're not going to play ETSU in 4 days. We're going to play Wofford in 4 days. So a totally different opponent. So what a like lesson for me in terms of just run your race. Just run your, the chips will fall where they may. You can't orchestrate it, not when you're depending on other people. Run your race to the best of your ability and see where it lands. And so what was crazy was we go through the handshake line because of the results of this final day of the season. Chattanooga, ETSU, and Wofford finished in a three-way tie for first. So I go to shake Coach Mock's hand at ETSU and I said, "Hey, I don't know if you know yet, but congrats." And she kind of looked at me crazy. And I get to the end of their line to their assistants, who are good friends of mine, and I said, "Hey, congrats, y'all." And they said, "Yeah, we know, but Mock doesn't." And I said, "Well, she does now." I had told her. And she and I had a good laugh about it. And so what was wild was we go to the conference tournament, and our path was Wofford in the first round, ETSU in the second, and Chattanooga in the third. We had to play all three conference champions. And so I told the team, there's not a team in the country, I don't care who you want to mention, UCLA, South Carolina, UConn, there's not a team in the country who had a harder path in their conference tournament, because none of them had to go through three champions on their way.
That is unique, a three-way tie, and you have to play them all. That's incredibly unique for sure. Obviously, some confidence built throughout the tournament, but take us through a little bit of the tournament. What are some things you learned from coaching in the tournament? Again, playing your best basketball at the right time of year.
Yeah, one of the things that I think we got right the week of the conference tournament was we did some special situations to prepare for late game scenarios, and they sh especially get it in safely, full court, get it in safely, sideline out of bounds, those kinds of fouling, how to. And sure enough, a bunch of those show themselves in each round, especially the first and second, in terms of we have a sideline out of bounds pressure release, and it was either the first or second game, and the team's at the far end, and the ball gets deflected out of bounds with 25 on the shot clock. So we got 5 seconds to get it across the timeline. And I holler at them and I say, "Listen to me." And they all lock eyes. And I told them, "We're going to be in line. You have 5 seconds to get it across." And we get organized. We get it into our point guard. She takes two dribbles. The trap comes. She skips ahead one more, open three. And like I don't know that those moments happen without the preparation to handle it. So that was one of the things that I thought we got right. Another thing that we got right was, and I was a little nervous doing it, was the when we got up to Asheville, where our conference tournament is, we go 2 days before we play. And so we have a day of prep. And on that day of prep, there was an impromptu wiffle ball game in the field adjoining our hotel between players and staff. And so I thought to myself, boy, if one of these players get hurt, I'm going to regret this. But man, if this isn't our culture right here, loving time with each other, competing. And so we played that, keeping it light, keeping it joyful, being prepared. I think those are things we got right. As far as like the things that I personally learned from, I think there was a moment in the Wofford game where I had drawn a play late in the game. They had made a serious comeback. We needed a basket, and I drew a play, and they ran it wrong. And I turned and slapped the scores table so hard that my fingers rang with a numbing sensation for about an hour. And one of the things that I learned throughout the course of the tournament is they're going to freak out if you freak out, and they're going to be relaxed if you're relaxed. Sustaining the relaxed, confident demeanor, posture. We went into the next round, and I told the staff, I said, "Your job is to bring positive energy. My job's to stay calm. Either of us get off course, we correct each other." And so from that point on, it was really cool to see.
Yeah, very cool. A great experience, no doubt, to be able to have your team playing so well at the end of the year. Then, of course, you win the final and you're going to the NCAA tournament in your first year as a head coach. That's pretty cool. Now, you've been there before, but I'm curious, who did you call? Who are some of the people you asked about some firsthand experience about what did you do? What were some of the things that worked, et cetera, to be able to help you prepare for the tournament?
Helps when you can call your mom for some advice. And
One of the all-time greats volleyball coaches. We talked about it on the first podcast for those that didn't catch that yet.
yeah, she coached 34 years at Florida and went to 34 NCAA tournaments. So she had pretty good experience with it. And getting to pick her brain, but also our coaches on campus and then the other coaches in my career. One of the things that was a cool moment for me is in the open practice in 2015 at Wyoming. We started the practice with one of our peer pressure drills, and it was everybody took a charge. And there's three coaches in the top, both corners, and a coach underneath the basket flips it to a coach, and they drive it, and you got to step up and take a charge. And Larry Shyatt, our head coach, took the last charge. And 11 years later, in the first round of the NCAA tournament, in our open practice, we all took charges, and I took the last charge. And so it was a fun little wink at him of appreciation. So, yeah, I talked to
I thought
him.
you were going to get Larry to take the last charge, maybe.
You know what? He was battling some stuff back home, but if he had been there's no doubt I would have put him on the floor for it.
No doubt he would have wanted to, too.
We make it back, I'm making him do it.
Yeah, they're good.
So that part was really fun.
I guess one of the main takeaways, I should say, from the first conversation was the hedgehog concept. You applied it to a lot of things, but player development in particular. So I'm curious, let's circle back to that. Did that hold true for you? And what were some maybe the KPIs that led you to believe that we were achieving these goals in terms of player and team development?
Yeah, I checked the stats and the analytics throughout the year, looking for trends and how we're trending and seeing us climb the ranks. Certainly in the 3-point shooting, we finished top 20 in the country in 3-point rate and 3-point makes. But seeing us climb the ranks when I didn't feel like we were very good offensively, I saw every flaw, I saw every wart, and seeing us constantly climbing in points per possession and effective field goal percentage and assist rate and the things that are telling of a healthy offense and a thriving offense. And so we're climbing these and I found myself going, I don't understand how. But some of the things that I will tell you that jumped out to me as far as the development stuff, yes, the understanding and the comprehension of the offense from a tactical perspective, how to play quickly in ball screens with, we did a lot of get action of hitting our bigs and playing off of those quick handoffs because teams were trying to crawl in us on our ball screens. That got better and better from a just a comprehension and the speed of which. So we run a set and the execution for the shot isn't there. The speed to flow to the next got so much better. From a technical standpoint, one of the things that I saw get better is we work a lot on live drive finishing with the concept of winning the line. I think this happens on the men's side, but I think it is really noticeable in the women's game. Is if you take from where you are and draw a straight line to the rim, can you win that line with the dribble? And a lot of times, because at some point in your career, you're more athletic, you're faster, you're bigger, you just think, I'll just go around them. And I'll eventually get around them. With the physicality in our game is if you start to go around and they bump you, you're going to be so far from that line to the rim, it's not even funny. And so we constantly talk about winning the line. And so are you taking their space? Are you being the one asserting your physicality to the rim? And we put in a boatload of time on that because in every element of our offense, driving is a piece of it. Even though I said we finished top 20 in the country in 3-point shots, that doesn't happen if you can't drive the ball. And so, unless you have a post that you can throw it into, and just that's not how we were constructed this year. And so we got really good, I'll say, at down the stretch of those kind of drives, of physical drives, of finishing towards the rim and not fading from the rim. And so our finish rate and our shooting percentage in the lane skyrocketed, but it was similar to the flywheel conversation. Is I can't tell you when that clicked, and I can't tell you which of those workouts and individuals that we did got them to comprehend it, but I know that put all of it put together, it worked. Some of the other stuff, as far as the development piece, is all that time that they put in on their mental skills training with our assistant Sally Higgins, that also showed itself. And so they were building their toolbox to be able to handle these moments of adversity. And we're up 20 or whatever it is in the second half against Wofford, and they come back and cut it to 2. We go down in the championship game to start the game like 13-2 or something to open the game. And you know how when you come to a huddle, there's a difference between the players who go, we're good, you're not good. And the players who come back almost quiet and it's fine. That's how it was. And it wasn't that way in non-conference. It wasn't that way early in conference play, but they worked on these tools. And whether it be their response to failure, whether it be their interactions with their teammates, whether it be breathing exercises, whether it be working on the narratives in their head, the stories they tell themselves, all that stuff then prepared them to when tough moments came, they thought to themselves, no, this is fine.
Well, experience is the best teacher, and you experienced a lot of that throughout the season, which again probably helped you at the end, didn't it? In that way, that going through these and having the good and the bad of those moments really helped you with that. Most important question of the day is literally now, what advice do you have for the first year head coaches taking over programs this year?
I think the two biggest things would be if you're all wrong together, you're all right. And to just whatever it takes to get everybody on the same page, staff, players, support staff, administration. I think whatever level of communication, meeting style fits you individually, I think getting everybody aligned is huge. That would be the first one. The second one, and I don't want to talk about another program that I'm not a part of, but I'm going based off of public comments from Kim Caldwell at Tennessee, where she publicly said, "We went to a plan B that was a watered down version of who we are, and I regret it." Essentially, it was something to that effect. And my advice would be double, triple down on who you are, on what you believe in. So stay the course in what you believe in, get everybody on the same path, and I think you have a chance.
Matt, I so appreciate you doing this from the first podcast to the second podcast. Just incredible value for all of us in the coaching community to be able to think about these things, whether you're a first-year head coach or not, just some of these topics that you experienced over this whole season. Thank you for sharing. But mainly, I guess, for us now, what's next? Where do you go from here?
Not that everybody that listens to this wants to hear it, but the reality is it's transfer portal season, right? So we're all focused on that. I think for us, though, more in a broad sense, I think the day and age of my parents and I were talking about this. There's the coaching adage that we don't become, you become us. And I think where we are with roster turnover, staff turnover, the moving dynamics in the uncertainty in college basketball and a lot of basketball generally is I don't necessarily, it's not we become you, but I don't necessarily think you become us either anymore. I think it's new creation. I think you look at the young creative coaches who, fair, have been in it a long time, but Dusty May, Corey Close, generally speaking, Todd Golden a year ago, like you're talking about young problem-solving creators. And I think that is where we're at. Yes, we are fortunate enough to return a lot, but half of our roster is going to be new next year. And so you're creating all the time. I talk to the people close in my life who are outside of basketball, who are in real-world businesses that I don't understand at all. And they talk about the difference between punching the clock and working for a startup. And the startup world, it's a million miles per hour and it's all creation all the time. And that's the world that we are living in right now in college basketball. And so for us, we're going to go back to the drawing table offensively and defensively and what's going to fit this new roster. And okay, once we decide on that, how do we teach that? What does June and July look like? What does the fall look like? And we're going to recreate it almost from scratch because that's what it is. And I'm so excited about that challenge. Wherever that takes us, whatever it looks like, that's what it's going to be for us. It is a brand new world of creation.
We're here for it. We're excited for it. And we thank you for sharing again with us and all the best for this second season.
Thanks for having me. You're the best.